Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started.
So these episodes are going to be a little bit different over August. We are going to relook at my favourite moments from the podcast from series one. We've had such amazing conversations this year, and thank you so much to everybody who has been on the podcast. You've been incredible, and thank you so much for all the listeners for your support so that we can continue this for series two from September. I hope you enjoy taking a look back at, my favourite moments.
He doesn't hate me. He hates the situation, but I know that he actually, in the end, feels secure in these boundaries. Yeah. And this is an agreement together, and we'll go ahead. So I suppose the first thing is to know what the do's and don'ts are, because they can't be reactive. You can't be seeing and decide in the moment. That's not fair. It's not fair on you or your partner, who's, whether it's a colleague or you know, your the partner of your child, managing that, because you're making up on the fly and mistakes are going to happen, aren't they?
And you're going to... and then that's in the system.
Exactly. So the idea is that you pick a calm moment away from anything going on where you can sit down. And I love that the children are involved as well, if they're able to be. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. And you can make it visual. As well, you know, the younger children, when we work with our TBBS families, we have pictures that they put in. We do images. And I think, you know, or even older children that find communication a struggle, anything that is a visual representation, a bit like the mood board. You know, like the goal setting it's the same thing. This is the family goal. This is what we're aiming at. We're not going to be perfect all the time, but this is what we're aiming at.
Learners, like anyone, could come into my class and say, well, there's no point them being involved because they wouldn't understand it. But let's just assume competent. Like, there is nothing, there's nothing wrong with them sitting around the table too. And who knows, like, who are we to say that they're not actually taking everything in? They just can't communicate it back.
And this is, I think, this is something that people do. I think we forget that understanding and being able to communicate outwards are so different in skills. You know, the amount of parents with toddlers that all of a sudden toddlers start speaking, they're like, oh my goodness, didn't know they knew all this. And you think, yes, but they had that skill and now they have this skill, so they can tell you what they know and what they've been
taking
in.
It's the receptive, isn't it?
It's such a...
So this is what I found with my
experience.
Exactly. This is what I find my students that have recently got an AAC tablet. It's all of a sudden, and you're like, well, you do know. And you know what? Now we're looking at every student differently, because we're like, you all know. You just can't, like, you've got all that receptive language. Or you hear it, you like, you'll see a little smirk, like, as you're talking or whatever, and you're like, you know. But you know what? Even if they don't, because disability is a thing, and some children like aren't aware, and they're perfectly beautiful and perfectly able to be part of that conversation too. Yeah. Like, that's okay. So sitting down together, deciding, right, when they do this, what do we do? You know, so we had a conversation, for example, right, nobody stands on the furniture. And I'm like, well, actually, like, sometimes it's okay to stand on furniture. When is it okay? So, okay, right. If it's higher than your hip, and it's unstable, we don't stand it. Great. So if it's lower than your hip and it's stable, then we can stand it. That's a really clear boundary. It works because I work with age 4 to 11 in my class. Yeah. So we couldn't say a meter tall because, you know, it's like, if it's taller than their hip and it's unstable, they can't stand on it. And then that's so clear. It's so consistent, because as the child grows, the boundary grows with them, you know, and it makes so much sense, doesn't it? So having really smart targets for yourself, you know, think about every eventuality. Yes, of course, we don't want them walking around with food, but what if it's a this day, that day, whatever, you know, is it every day that we don't want them? Or is it actually just at lunchtime? Or is it just at, you know, so just keeping it really consistent, trying to think of every eventuality,
writing it down. And flexible.
Yeah.
Which is
true.
For one.
It's true.
But that's life. And life is consistent and flexible. And we have to, we talk a lot about flexible seating. Yeah. You know, flexible routines and flexible expectations are so important. Yes. And appropriate expectations. Yeah. You know, there is no blanket. Yeah.
Like, oh, we decided this, didn't we? But actually, it's not a theme park, does it? Because at the theme park, we do walk around and eat our candy floss or whatever.
Yeah.
So actually, you're right. In this situation, this is okay. Is that all right with you? Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's go. Isn't it? I call it consistent compassion. So it's just, so it's thinking in the moment, actually, are we sticking for the boundaries just for the rigidity and the control?
The control.
Like we were talking about before.
Yeah.
Are we being compassionate in this moment? And often, yeah, it looks like pillars of rigid, doesn't it? Actually, children and humans go in and out of the pillars, but it still holds them. It's still the baseline. It's still quite comforting in that. But yeah, sometimes life happens and actually they can stay up later because it's a this day, or yeah, we don't have to have a bath on this Wednesday because it's this. And that is life. And that also teaches children not to be afraid of change as
and
well.
And it allows for that safe practice for children. You know, you were talking earlier about children that might not be aware of things, but we build awareness. That's how it works. We build awareness and we kind of heighten awareness. So children get to experience something over and over again. They get to learn within that safe boundary and practice it. And we talk a lot about this when it comes to behavior and expectations and routines and things. What we practice, we make progress in. And if we are not getting the opportunity to practice the skills within behavior and practice
moment, I am actually in a special education setting that's alone, attached to a mainstream school. So I'm seeing every day these mainstream children, with some of them with higher needs than the children in my class, and how that's managed. You know, sometimes it's they're really well supported, sometimes they have really great support staff who are really highly trained, and teachers who completely give them a sense of belonging and inclusion in their classes. And I'm also seeing the other side of things as well. I'm seeing children that are in the corridors. I'm seeing TAs without plans, that are having to think off the cuff, that are having to deal with really tricky situations, and children whose ultimately educational but also mental health needs just not being met. So I can see firsthand the need for this conversation.
I think it's so important to have, because like yourself, I worked in special education provision for 6 years. Absolutely loved it. But before then, I was in mainstream. So I did my degree in special education, and then I went into mainstream, and then I eventually went into autistic provision. And the need for inclusion is so important, but it's just not happening in the way we would like it to. We have these amazing centres for children with autism, with almost like higher support needs, and I think they do really well. Like you say, it's just absolute everyday practice. This is how we do it. We use our visuals, we use all those sensory breaks, just secondhand nature. But then in a mainstream setting, it's high masking, it's children fall through the gaps, because we have a big thing is it's assessments, it's grades. Well, they're actually doing really well educationally, so let's not put a plan in place, not focus on those other needs, because they're ticking a box of the grades.
Yeah, because sometimes these children are very high achievers, actually. They're your million word readers in my school. They're your tops. Oh my goodness, they're already ready for year six SATs in 8 years old children. But it doesn't mean that their needs and their sensory needs and communication needs and social needs aren't just as prevalent as the children in my class that are working at a very different level academically.
Exactly that. And I think it looks different. And people are like, oh, you know, if we go to that old language of, you know, high functioning, like, what does that even look like? It's actually not like that. It's a spectrum. It's they're still experiencing the sensory needs and everything, but different. It looks different for them. And because they are academic in that way, how we see as academia, it's but at what cost? Yeah. They're wearing that mask. At the end of the day, they're fine in school, I quote, but actually at the end of the day, they're coming home, they're burning out, and they have a biggest 4 o'clock explosion, because it's like, wow, I couldn't move. I'm trying to socially interact in the way that is meant for me. A lot of young people with autism will be very high empathetic as well, which is another misconception. So they can be really highly competitive, and all day they're thinking, oh, I did that wrong, I did this. And, you know, when you have, you know, mixed needs as well, so someone with ADHD as well as that, it's just constantly exhausting. And it's almost, in a mainstream setting, it's like, oh, well, are they choosing that behaviour? Well, actually, no, they're talking to you. Behaviour is communication, the biggest communication. And I think then we end up with kids in the corridor rather than, okay, what can we do? Who is it a problem for if they're sitting there, you know, with a visual timetable, with something that meets them where they're at, you know, not the things that we use.
When we're talking about the kids in the corridor, we're talking about literally kids that are educated in cupboards, under stairs, in miscellaneous rooms, in outside the head teacher's office, in corridors. They are taught in corridors. And sometimes it is because they are not coping in the classroom. But I still feel like children need to be taught in an education setting. So yes, okay, the lights might be too bright, it might be too loud, it might be too busy in the classroom. Okay, fine. Then it needs to be in the child's best interest to be educated elsewhere. It shouldn't be because they are disrupting the rest of the class. It shouldn't be because for the benefit of the 30 other children that this child can't be in the class. It needs to be beneficial for that individual child to make that decision. Ultimately, also, movement breaks and visuals support all children.
Absolutely.
Just because we're creating it for this one child to help support them, to, you know, have them as part of belonging, as part of this classroom. And if that's what's needed, then, you know, dimmer lights, visuals, movement breaks, if that's what's needed, then that doesn't hinder any other child from learning.
It absolutely doesn't. And, you know, so often in mainstream I've heard, and unfortunately in other settings as well, like they've got like a fiddle toy or something like that, it's distracting for the other children. And actually, you know what? Kids and teenagers are actually full of empathy. If you can actually explain, well, actually, and eventually teach them to advocate for themselves, I need this to focus, or this helps me feel calm. If we give children and young people those skills to advocate for themselves, more often than not, the other children will go, okay.
Exactly. So accepting of it. Yeah, so accepting. And also, I think if they're so easily distracted from their work task, from a silent fidget toy, then your lesson just isn't that interesting.
Or maybe they need one as well.
If a flower doesn't bloom, you don't change the flower. You change the environment it's in to help them bloom. And that is exactly what we're talking about here. If the child isn't coping in the classroom, if they're distracting, if they're disruptive, all these kind of words that we're hearing, we don't change the child. We don't, you know, we change the environment. Now, sometimes that does look like moving them out into a different class. Sometimes it looks like maybe using a quiet area, but also sometimes that just looks like offering movement breaks, visuals, schedules, and dimming the lights, offering fidget toys, encourage, you know, change that environment in order to better suit their needs. And another quote that comes to mind is also, so-called mild autism doesn't mean one experiences autism mildly. It means you experience their autism mildly. You have no idea how hard they have had to work to get to where they are. And I think that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Teachers, if you are seeing mild autism, you have no idea what's going on under the surface for this young person. Who knows? Maybe my children in my class are low maskers because they are less aware or less caring of what other people think around them. They stim freely. They communicate through their body and through behaviors because they don't have that maybe awareness or care of what other people think around them. But the children in mainstream class, maybe they do care. Maybe they are aware. Maybe they have been told that they're different. Maybe they, you know, have some kind of trauma in the past of having to, you know, keep their stims down because it's seen as behaviour. But that doesn't mean their need isn't just as high as the children that you see flapping and rocking and squealing in my class. And that's, they need their needs that need meeting. It's not a choice.
Yeah, this is it. It just looks different. And that's it. Like so many people I speak to, adults included, they're like, oh, I've never really thought that I stim. And I'll look at their hands and their nails and they're being picked. And they will go, well, I do this with my foot. And I'm like, yeah, that's how you stim. But then you also, on the backhand of that, my absolute bugbear is always, well, everyone's a little bit autistic. No, they're not. They're not. Like, you either are autistic or you're not. It may be that you've got high or low support needs, but, you know, it's actually it's a neurological condition. So you either are or you're not. We might have little tendencies, so to speak. it's like, you know, I have a craving for chocolate. I don't mean I'm pregnant. I just have that tendency right now. And I think, and this is all well-meaning of the community, because people are starting to learn about it, all these well-meaning things, but it's like, well, actually, no, that really...
Yeah, because ultimately, human autistic traits are human traits. Mm-hmm. It is a human trait to have interest. It's a human trait to feel anxious sometimes. It's a human trait to feel safest in your own, you know, environment. It is a human trait to be a little bit uncomfortable with transitions and change. Those are kind of butterfly feelings. They're all normal human experiences. So I think people hear these things and think, well, I feel like that. Maybe maybe everyone's a little bit autistic. I think that's where that comes from, isn't it? But it's the impact of those feelings that makes it autism, as well as sensory, you know, it's having all of it. At varying levels and changing throughout the day, but it's having that impact on your life. It is magnified to the point where it becomes debilitating. Not for everything, not for everyone. It looks different in everyone, but that's what makes it autism. That's what makes it diagnosable. So yes, you might share similarities, you might share traits, if you will, want for a better word, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's autism. But also, as we're talking about it, maybe it is autism. Maybe you're saying everyone's a little bit autistic because you're recognizing those high traits in yourself and you never even thought that you could be, because it looks really different in lots of people. Lots of women are only realizing that they're autistic because their children are being diagnosed with high support needs, and then they never even knew that, you know, they are autistic with low support needs all their life. Imagine you're seeing a child for the first time. How do you establish that initial connection? What kind of things are you doing, saying, thinking about in order to start that positively?
Yeah, the really first thing that might be a little bit surprising is that I don't say anything at first, at least the first 10 to 15 minutes of interaction with a child, because I just want to see who they are, what they are interested in, you know, are they interested in me or not really? So really kind of realizing that silence is okay at first, and there is no pressure really to talk or really to communicate with me at first. And it might look a little bit weird. It's like, you know, we're expecting the speech therapist to come in and really get started, and I'm there just like joining in their play very gently, or just being on the periphery. And I found that oftentimes it works the best when I'm this person who doesn't come in with an agenda, a person who comes in with genuine interest in whatever they're doing already and not trying to take their attention away from that thing. And I find this first step is the best one, and it really helps me to start creating that connection. It's not the sole thing that makes us feel connected, but it's kind of like opening the door a little bit and not kicking them out.
Yeah, and scaring them off with demands that maybe they can't achieve, maybe.
Exactly, yeah. And I find that so important, and I learned that through couple of years of practicing, because at first I was really excited, and really the speech therapist who came in like, what are you doing, and wow, can I do that as well? But soon I realized that's actually scaring the children, my enthusiasm. So I learned over the years that actually silence is best at first, so that the child feels that they are safe. This person, this stranger, really realizing about myself that actually I'm a stranger to them at first, and becoming that safe adult in the space that over time they will start trusting, because they will realize, like you said before, that all of the things that I'm doing are consistent and are not really threatening their inner emotional safety. So that's kind of the first thing that I really think about, and really kind of accepting their presence and their interest and following that. And I find that they teach me so much more than I would ever teach them through that strategy.
I loved it when you said genuine interest. And I think it's really easy to seem interested in it. A car rolling, or the wheels turning, you know. But to have genuine interest in it and see what is the joy that they are getting out of that. makes such a difference. They can feel it. You can feel it. That is what connection is, isn't it? It's not falsehood. It's genuine interest in it, whether it's interested in ocean animals or interested in spinning or interested in, I've got a child in my class that's fingers and we're really interested. What is it? Is it the fingers moving? Is it, you know, the physicality of it? Is it that they're seeing colours through the fingers? Is it counting? Is it songs in his head? You know, really interested, so that we can also be genuinely interested and drawing his joy in that. I feel like being genuine is the biggest part of being affirming and building that connection, isn't it?
I agree. And I love how you said that. It's all that goes in my mind. Exactly that. Like, why? Why is it interesting? And can I be interested in that in a genuine way? And really investigating a little bit, being a little detective as well in the background, whilst being silent and observing.
Yeah, so you are silent and probably quite still initially, to not scare them off. But your head's probably working tenfold, trying to work it all out.
It's so true. And I love how you mentioned that, you know, staying a bit still, because I don't try to move my body too abruptly in the beginning, just to see what their sensory regulation is like. And really not to scare them off as well, but also not to trigger any past traumas or anything like that. And I think that's also a big part of making them feel safe, because a lot of the time for children, we are these big humans with big bodies and they are so tiny. And it can feel so condescending almost, that we are so big and so above them. So really sitting down on the floor, a bit further away from them, being at eye level or below, never above. So those are the little things that over time I kind of gotten used to doing. But I don't realize that they are little steps towards the connection. So it made me realize right now.
I think that's helpful for people to hear, though. We've got mainstream teachers, new teachers, parents, siblings listening to this podcast. And I think this is the advice that people really need to hear, is those, things that maybe you do naturally that you've learned over years, to make yourself small, to be quite submissive in a way so that they can lead and feel in control of the interaction, I think is fantastic advice, because we could have the best resources, the best toys, the best, you know, all of these strategies, but if they're feeling out of control or scared and not safe, as you said, nothing's gonna sit right. It's not gonna feel neuroaffirming, is it? Even if you're saying the right things and using the right strategies, if you're towering over them, or even if you've got your arms crossed, or, you know, you're very aware physically, actually, I feel, when you're in these, and especially the initial stages, but actually in all interactions, I feel very physically aware. I used to be a dancer, and I do wonder if that helps, actually. I've just realised that now, because you're extra aware of where your body is in space and what your hands are doing and what your posture is. And I feel like it's almost like a dance, isn't it? Especially if we're talking about that initial interaction, that kind of intensive interaction way. It kind of is a to and fro conversation physically, isn't it? And if we're wanting them to feel in control and safe, well, then we need to be the smaller, quieter, stiller ones following their lead, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And oftentimes I feel like when I'm like very still and calm person in their presence, they start to be curious and they start to like looking into my direction, be like, who's this person and why are they there? And there we go, that's communication. And it just opens up without me doing anything. So it's just so magical to be a calm person and like near a small child.
Yeah. You might be the first adult that they've ever had enter their space and not put a demand on them ever. That's gonna set you up for intrigue at minimum, isn't it? It's definitely gonna help. It's not gonna hinder that connection building process. Do you often have other adults in the room with you, like other teachers or parents?
Yeah, I was just about to say that I'm almost never alone with a child. So there is always this in the back of my mind. It's not just about what I do, where I'm at in the room, but it's a lot about the environment as well. And how safe is the environment in terms of sensory stimuli, in terms of, you know, are we all emotionally regulated in the space? Are there other children there? And are they emotionally regulated? What are their sensory needs? It's a huge dynamic process of trying to figure it all out.
try and manage that, or are you just managing yourself? Do you try and move things out of the way? Do you try and turn off the lights? Do you try and hush adults down? How actively are you managing everybody else in the space? I know you're not trying to control the child you're working with, but is there some scope to control everything else, or are you just focusing on yourself and you just being the safe space?
I think it depends on the type of team that I'm working with, but most of the time, yes, there are discussions around what does an environment that's communication friendly look like, and what can we do to make it a safe space at all times, not just when, you know, I try to create a new connection with the child. So definitely there is a lot of conversations happening. I wouldn't say that they are happening at the moment when I'm doing a session with a child, but they are happening before and after, whether that's through informal chats or through training or through some modeling and coaching. There's always that ongoing discussion about how an environment that's affirming looks like. And through those discussions that are ongoing, it then makes whatever sessions start in the classroom much easier and more easier, really, to be said.
Yeah, I suppose because you all have the same expectation, don't you? They might be panicking that nothing's happening, maybe. Yeah. And actually you're quite happy. So I suppose to come in with all the same expectation is helpful. For everyone to know what success looks like is helpful.
Yes, exactly.
Now we've come over this social barrier that actually these loops are now a cool thing to wear. A lot of people that do come out of primary school when they'd use their fidget toys and they'd have their elastic bands and things that they became confident using actually was really beneficial to them. They just stop using them. They won't even, and obviously Senkos will chat to them and say, you know, you used to really benefit from this, it'd be great. And they're like, absolutely not, miss. No, not using it. No,
do you find not cool. They do other things though, like chew their sleeves or fiddle with pens, chew pens? Like, what kind of things are you seeing that tells you this young person needs these tools?
There's little tells like that, like the chewing of the sleeve is one, or picking of their nails is one. But actually in the teenage years, it's more acting out because it builds up. Yeah, it builds up. Because they're not having that release during the day. It builds up and then it comes out as behavior, which is obviously can lead to things like removing from the classroom, and then they're affecting their learning. And that's actually the start of the spiral. So it's really hard as a Senko to have those conversations with the kids when they're at that stage where the most important thing to them is how they look in school, you know, what their peers and their friends think about them. That's the most important thing to a teenager at that point. It's so hard for Senkos because you just want to say to them,
just do it, it's gonna help you.
I used to do it, or I know this isn't the coolest thing, but you know, it's, and that is probably the biggest challenge of working with teenagers. So with the loops, now they're cool, we don't have any problems with
good
them. But it's interesting how it's these society norms that if I could just click my fingers and think, right, if I could just make fidget toys cool, I would, because it would solve so many challenges that we have as Senkos, but also help the kids so much because they're so worried about what they look like as teenagers.
Yeah, so I suppose the difference with loops was that it was seen as cool because they might have seen influencers or celebrities wearing them. They're expensive, they're a high class, like high desired item. They're seen as being fashionable, just like certain trainers are, just like certain brands and designs are. So maybe the sensory toy business is missing a trick here. We need to be like getting the celebrities to be wearing big ear defenders and like using some fidget toys, and then maybe. Yeah,
if they're on TikTok, the kids will wear them, buy them. It's so funny. Any of these influencer TikTok dancers need to get on the fidget toys because it makes my life so much easier.
And that's so interesting as well, because we actually have the opposite problem in primary school. They are very much seen as toys rather than resources. So if a child sees a peer fiddling or twiddling with a fidget or whatever, they will want it. And then the teacher's in this weird space where they want to be affirming to their need. You know, maybe they do need it. Who am I to say they don't need it? To having 33 kids in the class that half of them are getting something out of it, or actually technically it'll be 25% are getting something out of it. And 75% are completely distracted because they don't actually need it in the first place. So
yeah, no, that's the opposite.
It's so different, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's the complete opposite of my problem. I remember being that age though. I remember being in those teenage years, and you just live in your bubble, and all you cared about was what was happening after school.
It matters so much. I do feel like secondary school is really crucial for teaching the important stuff. It really is, the academic stuff. But I think completely equal with that is learning about how to be in a social dynamic, how to make friends, how to form your identity, how to form positive relationships and to break negative relationships. You're learning so much important stuff that will also benefit you in adulthood too. And it's when those two things are trying to be together. I mean, secondary school is an absolute minefield, isn't it? You've got hormones as well. You've got, oh my goodness, yeah. Yeah, your job is not for the weak-hearted, for sure.
It is. I mean, I do love it. I used to not be a teacher, and then I came into teaching, and I do love it. And I'm glad I chose secondary. It is a crazy world to work in. It's interesting because I think I see these on Instagram all the time. When you talked about your classroom on my podcast a few months ago, we still teach with kids sat in rows. We still teach with kids having one exercise book for the whole class. We still teach with, you know, hands up. And I see it on Instagram all the time where it's, you know, how they used to school back in the 60s and 70s. It's exactly the same as what we do now. Even since I was at school, school has got so much harder. So much harder for kids. The exams that they sit and the intensity at which they sit them has got so much worse. So when did I sit my GCSEs? 2007? And my science exam was a multiple choice test.
Yeah.
Now it's done. It was 25 minutes. Now it's an hour and 15. And that's just one subject. And these kids are sitting 11.
Wow. Like,
intensity at which they work. And they come in, they sit at their desk, they listen to the teacher, they engage in whatever activity the teacher's set, but it will be at the desk, most likely, majority of the time anyway, will be at the desk and, you know, hands up, write your notes, move on to the next lesson. Unless you're doing drama, of course. But, you know, English, math, science, you can do some practicals, definitely. But the curriculum's so heavy that you do have to do quite a lot of theory work.
Benefit of that? Because as a country, we want better results. And if they feel like they're going to get better results doing more practical, keeping kids engaged, then why are they going the opposite of that?
There's such a breakdown in the understanding. I think, you know, all the people in charge of, I mean, who's the education secretary?
It changes so often.
Are they a teacher? Probably not.
Well, no, never. They're businessmen. Yeah.
Don't even follow politics because it drives me insane, but I can't imagine they're ever a teacher.
No.
Or someone that stepped into a mainstream 2000 kids secondary educational school. I doubt that they're that person. They could be, and apologies if I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong.
It's teachers are under so much stress. Like when I think of the science curriculum and what I have to teach kids, and it's just a memory game and a knowledge application game, and it's passing an exam, and it's just...
Which supports some people. Some people learn that way. Some people are very like book-led people. They can retain information. They can regurgitate information and they remember it. Does that make them standing citizens in adulthood? That's another question. But they can get through their exam. But for so many children, whether they've got a diagnosis or not, that would feel like an impossible task. I was one of them. I am an incredibly intelligent person. I have a six-figure business. Like, I am on it.
Yeah.
But I really, really just scraped C's in my GCSE. Like, and I've only got a degree because I chose acting, which was all practical, no essay writing. And yeah, because it didn't work for me. But as an adult, I found success. And I feel like children should have the opportunity too, because the school system is so built around one way of learning. It's putting people off from further education and any kind of academia or any kind of like teaching, for example, like any kind of career in a way, because they are so tired of feeling stupid. Honestly, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, no, and it is putting people off further education, but then we also live in a society where a degree is almost expected now.
Yeah.
So that's really, it really conflicts itself.
Yeah.
Because you're setting up an education system which favours a very small percentage of people. And then you're saying, well, you need a degree. And if you don't have a degree these days, people are like, okay, you don't get an interview. So my mum used to work in a bank and she had one O-level. Now you need a degree to have that job.
Wow.
And that was, we're talking, what, 30 years ago? It just frustrates me because the conversations I have to have with kids are, what do you want to do in the future? You know, they're choosing their GCSEs, they're choosing their A-levels. Choosing your A-levels determines what universities you're going to apply for. You're talking to kids about what they want to do in the future. Every single one of them expects them, they have to get a degree. Like, they have to. Like, there's no alternative. And if you do anything else, then it's a failure. But university was created for a very small, very academic group of people. You know, you sit in a lecture theatre for 2 hours and listen to someone and take notes. How many people could actually concentrate for that long?
And it's self-motivated as well, isn't it?
Yeah, regardless of your profile, God, that's a long time to sit there. So again, not everyone was meant to go to university. It was not meant to be a thing where everyone was meant to get a degree.
Like, we knew COVID was a perfect example. Everybody who had that kind of academic job was out of work. Who did we actually need? Or I suppose apart from nurses, bless them.
Yeah.
But yeah, who did we actually need? We needed on the ground skilled workers that are incredible, that have such great intelligence. It's just not academic intelligence.
Yeah.
They are practical problem solvers that are really hardworking and deserve so much more than often they get. But that's brilliant minds too. How do you know what system to try? So we said there's loads of AAC out there. We've got a mentally speaking child. What do we try first? What's a good thing to
feel
explore?
Like it's a loaded question.
It might be.
As a speech therapist, I think because I've had so many years of experience with familiarizing myself with systems and getting systems for children, that it's almost like my brain just like automatically processes all of this information and is like, yes, this is the one that I'm going to try. And sometimes for me to be like, well, why am I thinking that way? And being able to explain that is another thing. And it really depends. Sometimes I do like to look at, okay, is this child in a school system? Are they in a classroom? Or is there any familiarity with any sort of program? That shouldn't be the end all be all necessarily for choosing one. But if the entire classroom is using one program, maybe it's worth trying that program and seeing if they're successful. And if they're not, you know, we can switch gears and try something else, but they might have better support if we're going with what everybody, you know, in the classroom is used to. I live in an area where there's a very high Spanish speaking population. So I'm always looking at the bilingual aspects of that. So TD SNAP has a really, really great bilingual component that is, you can switch very quickly between languages. And that is usually high on my list of priorities if I have a family that is bilingual, especially a lot of the families here. One parent might not even speak English at all. So if I want them to use it, it needs to be in the language that they are using at home, as well as the language, you know, that the child is going to be experiencing in school. Also look at some of the motor planning things as well too. Do I feel like this child will benefit from a more motor planning based system, you know, like LAMP, where it's always snapping back to the home page, that organization of it, just based on some other, you know, characteristics that that child has. But I typically like to consider a few different systems and then say, okay, I think this one, you know, might be a good fit for this child and try it out. But there's been times when, you know, we're going through this trial period and I'm like, it just doesn't feel like it's, you know, I feel like there's something else that we can try. Yeah. And so I think also knowing it's okay to switch gears and not be like, well, this is the one I decided on, you know, that's why that period exists, to try these out and be like, okay, well, let's switch and see, you know, what system might work better and try a different one and see if we have a different outcome. But sometimes, honestly, you don't know. And I think as speech therapists, it's okay to feel like, I don't really know what system is the best one. And maybe I had this trial for 4 weeks with a child and they didn't touch it or look at it at all. And I have no idea what to pick. And at the end of the day, you kind of just have to use your best clinical judgment and then say, okay, well, once we get the device, like, I sometimes think there are kids where there is a program that this is the perfect fit for the child. But most of the time, the perfect fit is going to be the one that's implemented by everybody else. So
yeah, ultimately, it's if everyone else is using it, then that's gonna be the benefit. There's no point having the perfect program and no one else is using it,
right?
I think that's what makes so perfect sense. I think that's really great advice. Yeah, what are they using already? What is around already? What are their adults around them competent with or can access? because ultimately if that's not happening, the child isn't going to be able to access it either. And then yeah, motor planning is a really great, yeah, I hadn't considered that, but of course if a child doesn't have the dexterity to single out a single image on maybe a communication device, or then maybe symbols on blocks is a good idea, or objects is a good idea, or something like that. So yeah, it is individualized, isn't it, ultimately?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, trial and error, so have a hypothesis but then put it to the test rather than deciding before you've even tried it. I think yeah, it's where trials exist, exactly what you said. Have you ever seen really fast progress with access to AAC?
And it tends to happen with people who should have had it much younger. I used to work in a school system, and I mostly worked at the middle and high school level. It was a specialized school just for autistic individuals. So I had kids up to the age of 21 and adults. Some of these individuals had not been given access to high-tech AAC. And they may have been 14, 15, 16 years old or even older. And for some of those kids, sometimes it really was as simple as just like, I'm just going to put this in front of you and see what you do with it. And I did have a couple instances where, you know, pretty immediately those individuals were putting full sentences together.
Because they'd been using symbols, books maybe, and they'd been using communication books, and they'd been using iPads all separately, then it kind of makes sense to them,
and
I guess.
They were just older and had more exposure to language, you know, compared to maybe the 2-3-year-old little ones that we have. So I have seen that as well, too. And I've had some kids where, you know, like you said, they are immediately touching it the second that you put it in front of them. But maybe it's not in the way that we're, you know, expecting that to look like. And so it kind of just depends, I think, what that progress looks like.
Having something at the moment where I've got a pupil in my class who's been using it maybe for a few months. I'm using a communication device for about a few months. And he's really great. If we model to him on a single page, he can navigate it and finds it again and knows that he's doing it to request and to comment on like noun. So he'll find an animal, or he'll ask for a squeeze, for example. But he's really struggling to navigate between the folders, and we're finding that to be a barrier. Now we can continue showing and modeling through the folders, but actually what we're kind of going to is we're doing that for him and then finding him the page that he wants. I don't know if that's right. Have you got any advice for me personally on that?
Two pieces of advice that I normally give people for this. Kind of a caveat behind it is sometimes it depends on the system. Oh, is the system like you have to go 6 folders deep to get something? Because that is a lot for me, you know, as an adult. So sometimes before even getting to what should I do, it's looking at the system. And that's kind of where it comes in, where when I'm talking with families, you know, and back to what you had first asked about it feeling overwhelming, the more icons we have on a screen, the less navigation it actually requires to go into things. So sometimes looking at that and seeing like, okay, could we add more icons to each screen and then it requires less navigation? But two strategies that I typically use with kids when I feel like they're ready to be navigating and we just can't quite cross that bridge. One strategy I use is narrating out loud. So if I'm modeling the word open, I might say actions, page 2, open. So I'm actually narrating exactly which icons that I am pressing. Or for an animal, things, wild animals, tiger, saying that out loud and really slowing down while I'm doing it. And another strategy, I guess this kind of could fall under a level of prompting. And I think being careful to know like, okay, this child is really trying to express this. And this depends on the system. But if there's a search feature, a good search feature, so ProLocal2Go, really anything outside Touch Chat, the Touch Chat search feature often does not lead you the easiest path to get to a word.
Yeah.
But for the other programs, sometimes what I've done with some kids is search the word. And then when you click on the word, it actually will highlight it and black everything else out. And I will then encourage them, you know, to be able to walk through that motor plan.
Yeah.
And there's nothing else on the screen that can be kind of throwing them off. But sometimes just getting over that initial difficulty with it. But those are the two strategies.
That's really great advice. That's really great advice. Yeah, we use ProLoco. So using the search function is
a
really
great
idea.
So if you search it, it'll highlight, and then you click on, you know, which word, it'll highlight the motor plan pathway to get there. And I've had a lot of good success with that with kids.
Okay. social media is a great connector, as you said before, that of that's a great idea, or oh, we're even, or just start finding it difficult together. Finding it difficult.
100%. Like, just someone else to message at 4 a.m. when you're thinking you're the only person awake in the world. Yeah. And it's really lonely, but and you're really tired. And actually, when you then sort of on there or chatting to someone who is in exactly the same situation, like, for example, so Noah has melatonin. Mm-hmm. And I mean, to be fair, whether it helps or not, which he really knows. I think it does help a little bit.
It helps you get to sleep. It doesn't keep you asleep, I think. No, exactly.
And that's the biggest thing. But then we got the slow release tablets, and I was like, no, I'm having ARFID and only eating two foods. I was like, how am I going to get a tablet into him? But again, power of social media. Someone showed about like using a syringe with water. I was like, well, a syringe isn't going to work with Noah because again, that's too much demand. In the end, I was like, right, I'm going to put the little, because they're like micro tablets, into his straw in his drink. And now he drinks it, no problem at all. Doesn't even know it's there, just sucks it up.
More often than not.
But I wouldn't have even thought about that had I not in that post on social media. And actually that's been life-changing, because I would not have been able to get that tablet into him had I not kind of thought of a way in his drink. So I think, and it's just like those kind of everyday little tips that actually have such a big difference, because we definitely now know about the different areas of autism and like kind of the stereotypical what to do and how to help, but you quite often find that actually in the real life, where every child is different, neurodiverse or not, that actually they don't necessarily work for your child. So it's just about kind of getting as many tips as you can. And share it. And like, so at the end of the month, actually I'm starting this kind of parent support group for parents of neurodivergent children, and that is literally all about just getting together, like crying together, whether that's laughter or kind of tough times, sharing tips. Like, everyone will be at different kind of stages of their journey. I've kind of had like invaluable support from some of, they're actually parents at the school I work at, who have really helped when I've been through the HCP process with Noah. And like, until you've done it, you don't know these things. So then actually, and then it's too late, because you probably aren't going to do it again.
I hadn't even heard of what an HCP was.
Right, this is it.
Still don't really understand what it all is.
Luckily, I've done it.
Yeah. But that's true. The support network can be fantastic. Is it in person or virtual?
Yeah, so, well, it's definitely like, so this will be the first meetup, and we are going to do this in person, which will be kind of for Colchester-based families in Essex. But then I don't know. I don't know where it will go, really, whether it will go into kind of doing virtual events. I'll probably do some like locally and then some virtually, and whether it will be just socialising or whether potentially I'll do some kind of sharing of information as well in the long term.
Chat group or something that you can just informally message.
Exactly. I just think like the power of kind of community and finding people in a similar situation to yourselves, that's definitely helped me more than anything. And I think like as a dad, like that isn't something you've
I was going to say, females are so good at that. It's social media and building connections. How do you feel, Stuart? Do you feel like that would be helpful to you, or that kind of social media stuff? Because there's not many fathers out there.
To be perfectly honest, I'm still a bit like, whoa, I don't know whether I fully commit to, I don't know, I guess if I'm being completely honest, it comes down to kind of an acceptance that my child is not kind of neurotypical. There's still that, if I give in, if you like, then that's all over and I'm sort of losing sight. But that being said, I kind of second feed everything that this one gets.
Yeah.
But it's tough. I can't quite explain it, but as a dad, you're kind of macho and you want the best and you want this and that and you want your son or daughter to be the best. And then you get hit with this wave of autism and neurotypical and...
Yeah, global delay. Yeah.
It's like, my God, what is my child gonna turn up? Are they gonna have a normal life? And it's kind of,
and no one can answer that. So I've worked with 400 plus children, lots and lots, that everything you're describing, Noah, I can kind of imagine it.
Yeah.
And I still can't tell you what could or couldn't be, because their journeys are so different. They say, don't they, you meet one autistic person, you've known one autistic person. Every single child I have is not similar to each other in any, or in some ways, but they really are unique. I'm not just saying that. And some have gone on to go to college and have jobs and live semi-independently or independently and have relationships. And others haven't. Others live in assisted living or live at home or live with siblings. Some of them volunteer. Some of them don't. They have a PA and they go out for the day. There are so... And they all look like Noah at five.
Yeah.
So I can't answer the future just as much as any other person can. And I don't know if that gives you comfort or not. It's just...
It's the hardest thing, isn't it?
That's the hardest thing. Like, it's a journey for Noah and it's a journey for us. And it's just... accepting it, and whether you embrace it full on straight away or you gradually kind of come into it and learn and take little bits. I think for a guy, going to a group is really quite like frightening.
Yeah. Whether it's a divergent parenting
or
group,
whatever.
Like you just wouldn't, like normally, stereotypical, isn't it? Like the dad is normally full time work. And then the mum is the one who's part-time. And I know that's not always.
And you've got your friends and...
She was always like, I've got loads of friends. They're great. I don't need any more.
But it is true. Like, they don't get it.
No, they don't. And they tried, but they can't.
Yeah. So...
And I think that's for me why I'm like, I don't think, and it's no reflection on them as friends, but like parenting a neurotypical child, you just can't get it because actually is... Unbelievable, some of the things that happen, and we're like, oh my god, what is happening? Like, yeah, I think that's probably been the thing we've found most throughout the like journey of Noah's life so far is that people can kind of suggest things or like you can go to different things, but until you are ready as a person and until you've almost got to that, I think you like do accept that Noah's autistic, but equally probably would like to change that. If we're being honest.
And I think acceptance is constant. I don't think acceptance is ever finished.
No, for sure.
I think with every day and moment, acceptance has to grow. And because so much is unknown, how could you ever now accept who he's going to become when you don't know what that is? So I think it happens daily, yearly, moment by moment. Situation by situation is that acceptance is, you know, first of all not accepting and then growing and then accepting and then there's a new situation not accepting. I think it's consistent acceptance. I think that's another thing that people don't realize. It's just constant.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it is, like you hit the nail on the head, it's just so hard because you just don't know. You don't know what's coming. And like I always say, we spoke about this before.
Yeah.
I was like, I would love a crystal ball.
Like a timeline.
To like see, right, this is where we're going to get to.
And but I don't know whether I would.
I don't think you would like that. But I would love that because I would then know. I think anyway, I'd like it. Mm. But I'd then know. I would know what we were working towards. Like I would know the end goal. And then I feel like I would then be easier able to accept that. Whereas Stuart's like, oh God, no, I'd hate that. I wouldn't want to like see into the future. It is tricky. But I think also when you are so exhausted, and I have definitely been through this stage, I didn't want to connect with people because I was just so tired.
Yeah, you had nothing left.
And I didn't have anything left. And I still definitely go through times of that where I'm like, oh, I'm so mentally drained.
It's a huge effort.
Yeah.
Go and put on your kind of happy face.
And also they're putting on their stuff onto you and you're only just managing your own stuff. That's that kind of weird social thing, isn't it? Of like, oh God, yeah, but they might want me to help them. Yeah, and I can't do that.
Through my job, like I'm not saying so, but I've done the qualification and I've done kind of the acting role for a bit as well. So a lot of families at work, if they do have a child who it has additional needs, they will come and talk to me. So I do that through my job, which then probably means that I find it easier like in my personal life too. Whereas I guess like in your role, it's nothing at all to do with kind of neurodiversity or like parenting. So actually that's so different that is kind of far removed from like your norm maybe. And that's why it isn't necessarily something that you find. But then equally, we have had conversations where Stuart's like, oh, like they just totally don't get it, or it's really sad because like the guys are talking about their children doing this, like, and that's so different to Noah, like with fights, wasn't it?
Yeah, like both of my good friends have got similar age kids to Noah, and they were talking about riding a bike or, and it was like, I was just like, I'm just so far removed from this conversation
And those conversations are going to sting, no matter how much you love and accept your child.
Nothing on them or nothing.
It's just that reminder, isn't it, of what milestones he he may or may not reach, and he certainly isn't reaching now.
And like, and it is, I think I almost, although I say I'm really accepting, sometimes I just don't think about it. Like, that's probably my coping as well. Like, can't think about it too much on a like personal mummy level, because that's too emotional and too tricky. But actually I can think about it on like a, not on a professional level, but almost on a like.
So you go into your like, this is how we're going to do, this is what we're going to do, this is what our strategies we're going to use.
Oh, great.
I do that, don't I?
I just break down.
Like, yeah, I think so too. And sometimes too, it's like, oh, that's like a really like
matter of fact
way of thinking and talking about it. But I'm not trying to do that. Yeah. I think it's just my coping mechanism.
Yeah.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed taking a look back at some of my favorite moments from series one. If you would like to be on my podcast for series two, then please get in touch. You can email me at oursensorykids@gmail.com or just send me a DM on social media, and I'd love to have you on. See you next time.